Good morning again. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I don't know if we have any guests or visitors, but there will be a time a little later on in the service where you may introduce yourself if you so desire. Prairie tries to be and generally succeeds an open-minded and open-hearted congregation where you are welcome, no matter your gender identity, your sexual preferences, your color of your hair, your eyes, your skin, no matter your abilities or disabilities, but most importantly, no matter where you are on this journey of life, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first services here, we do encourage you to come more than once. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. But sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, and often outside speakers will come in. The opening words are from Alice Walker. Love is not concerned with whom you pray or where you slept the night you ran away from home. Love is concerned that the beating of your heart should kill no one. Holly, would you light the chalice, please? May the lighting of this flame renew in us our endless search for all that is right and true, our abiding love of life and all who share this life, and our unending dedication to following paths of peace and justice. Now, in keeping with my quest to continue to educate us about who Frederick Douglass is, I invite anyone who wants to come up to hear the story, which is about Frederick and another famous person. Now, before I start the actual story, just a little bit of information for the, well, I was going to say bigger people out there. You're not bigger. That's okay. Not to worry. The people who are out there. Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony actually met each other. And among other things, they would have tea once in a while. The reading that I want to share with you this morning is True Wisdom by Unitarian Universalist Minister Kathleen McTeague. She writes, in the famous illustration of King Solomon's wisdom, two women came to him fighting over an infant. Each had given birth to a baby boy just days before, and they were sleeping in the same room together when one of the babies died during the night. Awakening to this calamity, the mother of the dead baby switched the two and claimed the living one as her own. But the other mother knew her child and refused to give him up. So they came to the king for resolution. Solomon listened to this argument, and then, as many of you know, he called for his sword. He told the women that since there was no way to know which of them was telling the truth, he would simply divide the baby equally, as though they were fighting over a loaf of bread. And they could each take half. One of the women agreed, but the other immediately cried out, "No, no, no, give her the baby. Don't kill him." Solomon, of course, gave the baby to that woman, the one who preferred to lose the fight and the baby rather than see him killed. The story ends with these words, "All Israel stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him." McTeague writes, "I was a little kid the first time I heard this hair-raising story. And unlike all of Israel, I didn't stand in awe of the king, but in terror of what might have happened. What if the real mother hadn't spoken soon enough or had said the wrong thing? Would the king have gone through with it just to make his point? I imagined the tiny baby with a cold sword poised over him, and it all seemed terribly unfair and cruel. And what about the mother of the baby who died in the night? I kept wondering what happened to her after Solomon revealed her deceit and humiliated her so publicly. Clearly, I had an overactive imagination as a child. But all my questions really added up to this. What good is a clever solution that comes without kindness? If this story is going to stand as an example of wisdom, we have to imagine it continuing on past the sword that frightens the truth from a couple of anguished mothers. If he's going to be lifted up as a paragon of wisdom, we should expect a little more of Solomon. Let the rightful mother have her baby, gloriously alive and intact, but then let the king be wise in heart and mind, head, heart and head, so that when he looks at that other woman, he sees more than just a liar caught in the act. Let him see a mother out of her mind with grief and loss. Let her presence remind Solomon of his own lies, his own unbearable losses, and so bring him off his throne and down on his knees next to her where she huddles. Let him speak some word of kindness, then lift her up and walk with her back to the cold room where her deepest fear and sorrow lies wrapped in a still bundle on the bed. Let him stay with her there quietly to help bear this most grievous of losses, a dead child. If it's wisdom we're after, we must remember that the truest wisdom comes laced through with compassion. As we come to know how alike we are, each of us doing our best to find that path ahead and to keep on walking with our fragile, broken hearts. And all of us in deep need of each other's kindness. Each of us doing our best to find the path ahead and to keep on walking with our fragile, broken hearts, and all of us in deep need of each other's kindness. Compassion is another word for love. Other words that we sometimes use to mean love could be empathy, sympathy, maybe sometimes kindness, maybe the word understanding. There aren't many words, really, that we use in place of the all-purpose word love, other than that beautiful word, compassion. On the other hand, most of us, probably, at some point in our education, learned that there are different forms of love. Eros, agape, platonic love, puppy love, true love, mature love, tough love. The important point here is that whatever language we use to try to talk about love, to capture what it is, to understand its essence, we should always be striving to expand our definition of love, to enlarge what we usually think of when we think of love, to challenge accepted cultural norms of what love is. Unitarian Universalist minister David Blanchard writes, "Most of us look for love in only the most obvious places, and as a result, most of us come away disappointed. It's as if we are still grade school kids counting Valentines as a measure of what matters. The love that matters is not typically the subject of sonnets or love songs. There can be love in being told we are wrong. There can be love in sharing a regret. There can be love in asking for help, which I know Unitarian Universalists are not real good at. There can be love in communicating hurt. There can be love in telling hard truths. It isn't the kind of love we've been promised in the fairy tales of princes and fairy godmothers, but it is the kind experienced by frogs and dwarfs. What part does hate play in love? Last week, one of you pointed out that it is often said that the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. I'm not going to spend any time on that this morning, but we could spend a Sunday morning service pondering that statement. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. But I would like to briefly consider hate this morning and its role in love. I think that Blanchard is on to something when he writes that there can be love in communicating hurt and in telling hard truths. And there can be love in trying to get to the root of hate, to the source of intense dislike. I heard part of a fascinating interview on National Public Radio yesterday morning. It was between a woman who had voted for Trump and a woman who had not voted for Trump. They were remarkably similar women, about the same age. They were both nurses. They had the same number of children. Did anybody hear it? Because I didn't hear the end.
Oh, no.
I don't know if they resolved anything, but I was fascinated about it. I'm very interested right now, and I think a lot of you are, in how we're going to dialogue with people we do not agree with. And not only, first backing up from that, how do we even find them? They're not in this room, by and large, if we're talking about big picture here. I don't know, but I'm working on that, and many groups are. Look at that quote by James Baldwin at the top of your order of service. Baldwin writes, "I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense, once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain." Yes, I think that is true. This is not about the pain of breakups that we have probably all suffered, perhaps as adolescents, or perhaps as adults experiencing painful partings, going through a divorce. Garrison Keillor once remarked that everyone is entitled to at least one poor choice where love is concerned, a choice that often results in a broken heart. But the kind of pain James Baldwin means is the exquisite pain of beginning to grasp, as we mature, horrible truths. For example, this country's treatment of its native peoples, and then the treatment of people of color, which continues into the so-called modern times. I have said before that humanity in general, and our country in particular, will continue to be stalled. We won't reach our potential until humans are able to talk about the horrible things we have done to each other throughout history. If I love you, no matter who or where you are, even regardless of who or where you were. My inner mystic coming out now. No matter where you were in the entire history of humanity, I will be in pain over atrocities, oppressions, injustices. And there will be fear in my awareness. And there will be pain in letting ourselves be vulnerable enough to confront hate, past and present hate. Now, this isn't original thinking on my part. I've put it into my own words and expanded on it a little, but I've mentioned Joanna Macy before, and there are many others who this is their life's work, is trying to help us recognize the pain, talk about it, work through it. We're not getting over there to love until we do that. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions come to mind for me, especially the one in South Africa, because I was fortunate enough to bicycle through South Africa once, not long after apartheid officially ended, but of course it hadn't ended. The first Truth and Reconciliation Commission to use that name was, anybody know? The TRCs, in Chile, in 1990. But there have been TRCs in Congo, Sierra Leone, Nepal, Panama. Germany has fairly recently had two discuss human rights or to come to terms with human rights violations in East Germany. Both Canada and Australia have had Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in fairly recent times. They tend to call them national inquiries into blank, but usually the next part of that phrase is something about Indigenous people and the legacies, of course, of residential schools for those Indigenous peoples. We have to work through the pain of acknowledging our hates and biases and prejudices before we can get to that place of love. Well, this is not easy, as you might imagine. We nudge that process along whenever we gather on a Sunday morning, I hope, and voice our pain, yes, but we also, I hope, help the process when we verbalize stories about love and about searching for common ground. And that search is in and of itself a form of love. Our lives flow on in endless songs, whether we want them to or not, above earth's lamentations. But love prevails, or will. How can we keep from singing, from laughing, from joy, from love? Unitarian Universalist minister Jane Rani Zepka opens one of her meditations with this line. Somewhere I got the idea that Valentine's Day is part of our liturgical year. So every February, I feel obliged to write about love. Well, I always laugh at that line because somewhere, way back when I first discovered Unitarian Universalism, I too came to believe that Valentine's Day was on our liturgical calendar. Last week when I talked about Howard Thurman, I concentrated on three of his rules to live by, though he did not label them that way. I drew them from various writings and memoirs of his. These three wise guidelines are, to refresh your memories, or if you weren't here last Sunday, not in any particular order. One, the contradictions of life are not final. Two, keep open the door of your heart, making of it a swinging door. And three, keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve. Thurman said a lot about love, including these challenging lines, which I have slightly edited to make them more inclusive. The experience of love is either a necessity or a luxury. If it be a luxury, it is expendable. If it be a necessity, then to deny it is to perish. So simple is the reality, and so terrifying. Ultimately, there is only one place of refuge on this planet for each of us, and that is in another's heart. To love is to make of one's heart a swinging door. So, I'm weaving together a lot of strands here, including, of course, Howard Thurman. If you weren't here last week, look him up and be prepared to spend the next year reading about him and reading what he wrote. So kind of aiming towards a successful Valentine's Day here for us all. I should mention, though I don't have time today to go into detail about it, another strand that we might think about when we're weaving our working paper, as Thurman would have put it, our working paper for our lives. There's another strand called, and some of you will have heard of this, Standing on the Side of Love. This is a Unitarian Universalist Association. Well, it started out as a campaign kind of thing. It started out as a response. Well, first of all, in 2004, it started out as a response to the way that we were treating GLBTQ community in this country. But then in, I think, 2008, there was a shooting. I don't know how many of you know this. In a Unitarian Universalist congregation in Tennessee. I want to say Nashville. But
Knoxville,
thank you. I think it was Knoxville. And that's when Standing on the Side of Love became sort of official. Well, the program committee, and I sit on the program committee, and some of us thought, it was very vague. I mean, who isn't standing on the side of love? Are you going to admit it if you're standing on the side of hate or even indifference? So resonate with us. Until recently, they're getting a little better, and now they have an official website, standingonsideoflove.org, look it up. So there are some definite actions to take, but we do a lot of those actions here, I think. Plus, we live in Madison. If we can't find actions here, go out there. Stay in Dane County, though. Howard Thurman's lifelong quest. The essence of his working paper was, this is what he really wanted to do, and I talked about this last week a lot, but it's worth repeating, to take the particulars of his individual life and place his particular experiences, the ones unique to him, and of course, unique to each one of us, our experiences. He wanted to take his own experiences and place them within the framework of the universal experience of being human, of what it means to be human. This would bring us to common ground. This might help you understand why he's sometimes described as or accused of being a mystic, because of his firm belief from his head and from his heart that everything is connected. Do you remember, not last week, but a few weeks ago, he told you the rattlesnake story about Thurman? And when he was six, seven, eight, and he lived in Daytona, Florida, he went to a friend's house to play, and there was the sister of the friend, who was at most one and a half, two, sitting in the yard of his friend's house playing with a rattlesnake. And the rattlesnake would crawl over to the little girl, curl up and kind of in her lap, and then she'd pick it up and fling it. And it would come back. And of course, Thurman, being 7'8", he thought this was great, but the little girl's father was at a window kind of going crazy with his shotgun, but what could he do? Everything was fine. And the rattlesnake, well, except that the little girl's father shot and killed the rattlesnake eventually, but that was that kind of harmony that Thurman's talking about. I don't really think that we're going to get there, but who knows? There's another Thurman story I'll tell you. One summer when he was in high school in Jacksonville, Florida, remember he could not go to high school in Daytona because there was no high school for black people there. So he actually ended up living during the summer in Jacksonville when he was in high school. And he needed to work. He always had to work in the summers, even though he was just a kid in high school. Well, he had lost a job, and he was at loose ends. What was he going to do? How was he going to earn any money? And then, he was sort of sitting on a curb thinking about this. And he looked over, and he saw a mansion that belonged to a man named James Gamble, who had a winter home in Jacksonville. Thurman thought, I'll write him a letter, because I know that he's often looking for somebody to take care of the house during the summer. So he wrote a letter and then realized he didn't have an address and he couldn't figure out how he could get an address. So he was about ready to give up on that idea. And he was bicycling past a house of, in his words, a very ill-tempered woman who came running out of the house and yelled, "Boy, come here. You look like a boy who can be trusted. Here, mail these letters." Took the letters, because that's how things were then. Went on his way, and just before he put them in the mailbox, he glanced at them, and in his words, to my utter amazement, one was addressed to Mr. James N. Gamble, 1430 Union Trust Building, Cincinnati, Ohio. It's that Gamble, Proctor and. The contradictions of life are not final. Howard Thurman had that deep, abiding faith in love. He knew somehow he would contact James Gamble. He did. Thurman got the job. And for all the remaining summers that he was in high school in Jacksonville. What does it mean to be fully human? How do we translate one particular life experience into that stream of universal experience? Well, I know from my own life experiences that this is not easy. At the same time, I have come to a realization and understanding that so many of my experiences have been invitations to that universal experience, clues to what humanity's common ground might look like. My stories, and probably yours, all have an element in them of groping through murkiness, because life is murky and messy, towards common ground with my fellow humans, toward those three truths of Thurman's. My stories, and yours too, are all about a search for love. Here are a few of mine. My wonderful, ever so curious mother could embarrass us on occasions. In the mid-50s, we were driving through the Deep South. We took this trip every year to visit an aunt of my dad's. And really dating myself. You know I'm old. So there weren't any freeways. There weren't any interstates. They were just beginning to appear because they were an Eisenhower thing, pretty much. So we're on little two-lane roads, and we're driving through Georgia. And marshes on each side, but occasionally houses, more like shacks. But we knew, as my parents would have said them, the Negroes lived there. My mother really wanted to see inside one. And she kept bugging Dad to pull over. Pull over, I want to look in there. Pull up. Now, she didn't, there was no malice in my mother. She was extremely curious, and she wanted to know how other people live. So Dad finally gave up, pulled over, and I don't think there was anybody home. I don't remember anything awful happening. But she got out and looked around. And I think I told you last week about my confusion when we would take these trips in the two drinking fountains. Mm-hmm. My confusion because of my upbringing, my Presbyterian Sunday school upbringing. Fast forward to 1965, Cleveland, Ohio. Anybody know what the equivalent of Watts is called in Cleveland? The Hough area, H-O-U-G-H. I lived not very far at all from the Hough area. In 1965, there were riots in the Hough area. I don't know what possessed us. This must be my mother's genes. But my then husband and I, with our one-month-old child, decided we wanted to drive through the Hough area to see what all was going on, what was all this about. Now, we knew it wasn't necessarily safe, but we did this very early on a Sunday morning. Didn't see anything. But whatever that is, that murkiness that we try to get through to understand what life is all about, back up a little bit to Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1962. I was a freshman at American University. I loved to walk then, I still do, and I was walking around in not the best area. in Washington, D.C. I didn't think anything of it. A taxi driver pulled up beside me and told me I need to get out of there. Ninth graders were with me in a car in the late 70s, early 80s. It was a coming-of-age class, and we were taking a trip to Chicago to do all sorts of things, including going to a polo game. And I was trying to find the polo match, and I got lost, really lost, and ended up in a not very good area of Chicago. Pulled into a store, just a corner store, where the man was very helpful. He had a map on the wall, and he showed me where I should be, and he said, "You got to get out of here. You have to hurry up and get out of here." More recently, and this one is really disturbing, I had a similar experience in New Orleans, wandering around, walking around in the late 70s, where a taxi driver came up to me and said, "Get in, I'm getting you out of here." I didn't feel any danger, that's another story. But this, the two other ones, the one happened in 1994. I think I've talked about Samuel from seminary days, and in the laundry room, he asked if he could borrow some soap, and then he got teary-eyed, and he said, "Help me, I'm supposed to do this autobiography thing in a class, and I don't know how open to be." Samuel was from South Africa, a black man from South Africa, and he took his shirt off and showed me all the welts from the beatings he'd had in South Africa. And then the most disturbing one, not most disturbing maybe, but the most recent incident like this that I had was walking at the Madison Airport a year and a half ago. I was behind two white TSAs. And all of a sudden I tuned into what they were saying, and one of them said, I'm paraphrasing, of course, I'm not prejudiced. I know I'm not prejudiced, but come on. Who's in the prisons? It's all black people. Of course they're inferior. I was so stunned, I didn't say anything. I thought of a lot of things to say since then. And then, of course, there's always DWB. Largely because of seminary, I know several black men, and every single one of them has been stopped at least once, usually more than once, for the offense of DWB. Driving while black. Now, obviously, none of us, except perhaps in a mystical moment, can fully experience all that there is to experience of other people's lives and histories. And that's where books and movies come in. They can be so important. They transport us into other lives, into the particular experiences of others through stories that we would otherwise know nothing about. Recently, I've seen Moonlight and Fences and Hidden Figures and learned so, so much. And then even in La La Land, which I've seen more than once because it helps me keep my sanity these days, when one of the stars sings, "Here's to the ones who dream, foolish as it may seem, here's to the hearts that break, here's to the mess we make." I am reading Common Ground by J. Anthony Lucas, subtitled A Turbulent Decade in the Lives of Three American Families. Lucas won a Pulitzer Prize for this. It's a mere 650 pages long with very small print. But it weaves together the stories of three American families in Boston for a decade, roughly from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s. He takes you back so far with these three families, a black family, an Irish family, and a Yankee, Boston Brahmin family, that you just sympathize with each one. I suppose one of the reasons I am so crazy about this book is that it is a beautiful example of Howard Thurman's lifelong quest to take the particulars of our individual lives and to reflect upon how these particulars are relevant to the universal experience. We need to make Valentine's Day much more universal on the greeting cards. I still send them. And on those, unfortunately, not very tasty little candy Heart shape. I'm sure those are still around. How, why can't we put things on those little candies and on greeting cards like, make love, not war. Ban the bomb. How did our oil get under their sand? Which was a sign I saw at a protest at the second Iraq war. I love that one. And almost all of the signs that I saw at the march on the 21st of January. Because laughter is a necessary component of love, I will end my remarks first with two very short Robert Fulghum stories, and then with some Unitarian Universalist Valentines, and with a little help from members of the audience, featuring words that could be written on those cards and candies. Fulghum tells about a middle-aged man in a suit and tie. This was after Fulghum, I don't know, do people still know who Robert Fulghum is? Unitarian Universalist minister who became a very popular author for such books as All I Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. It was on fire when I lay down on it, yes. He has one called True Love, and Uh-Oh was another one of his. Well, he asked for people to send in their stories for Valentine's Day, and this man, as Fulghum says, in a suit and tie, carrying the Wall Street Journal, came up to me and handed me a pale blue envelope, perfumed, the kind used for personal correspondence. He said, before you read this, you should know that I've had it for at least 10 years, that it's from my wife, to whom I am still married. Inside the envelope was a matching sheet of stationery with these words written with pen and ink. My dearest Harry, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Respectfully, with all my love, Edna. I smiled and looked up, anticipating the rest of the story. He smiled as he refolded the note, put it back in the envelope, and said, that's it, and walked away. The shortest love story of all I collected, says Fulghum, is this one, from a waifish little girl of about 4 years old who stands by, staring at me, sucking her thumb, and holding a raggedy yellow blanket up to her face. Do you love your blanket? Child nods her head. Yes. Does your blanket love you? Child shakes head, impatiently. No. Of course not. And then this. Here's the entire text of a love letter intercepted by a second grade school teacher, passed on to a parent who passed it on to me. Dear Billy, if you don't, no apostrophe, if you don't say you love me and walk to the bus stop with me, I will kill myself and beat, B-E-E-T, you up. I love you and I love you and one. W-A-N, supposed to be want, I'm sure, to marry you soon, Susie. The little girl was 8 at the time. The parents showed me the letter when the girl was 24 at a rehearsal dinner the day before Susie married Billy. During the service, I shared the letter with the guests, and in her vows had Susie repeat after me, I, Susie, promise you, Billy, never to kill myself or beat you up. If the marriage lasts as long as her love, and her love is as large as the laughter in the ceremony, the odds are good for happy ever after. Now, I have asked some folks to read Unitarian Universalist Valentines. Wait for the mic, please, each of you. And Chris, you're starting. Chris needs the mic.
Love is all you need.
Let's let our interconnected webs interconnect, baby.
I love you more than fair trade coffee. Almost.
We go together like a flame and chalice.
I forget because I didn't write it down. Who has, what number were you? Who's 5?
You are the answer to my prayers, meditations, and/or quiet moments of quiet reflection.
Will you join the committee of my heart?
I love you more than Thoreau loved the woods.
Oh. True love, you light my chalice.
And this last one. Every day I thank, please check one, God, the universe, the unnamed, the spirit, earth mother, all of the above, none of the above, for you. I don't know. I guess we could skip the responsive reading. You can all read it yourselves if you want to. It's a classic. It's the responsive reading is the one about love. From 1 Corinthians, if you do all these things and don't do these. 1 Corinthians. From Mother Teresa, love cannot remain by itself. It has no meaning. Love has to be put into action, and that action is service. Whatever form we are, able or disabled, rich or poor, it is not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing, a lifelong sharing of love with others. May it be so. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, drink your coffee, go to meetings as applicable.
And buy stuff from...
And, oh, it's that day.
Yes, it's that day.
Oh, and buy things. Goodies from Just Bakery. Just Bakery.